Welcome to the eMind Podcast with Dr. Carrie Oberbrunner, where we're committed to helping you think like an entrepreneur and gain an exponential advantage. This podcast is sponsored by Igniting Souls and Cedarville University. And now, get ready for the eMind.
Hey, everybody, it's Carrie Oberbrunner. I have with me a very special guest. In fact, I've been trying to get her on board for about a year. She doesn't know that, but Katie Rubino of Caldwell IP. How are you doing today?
Good morning, Carrie. Thanks for having me. I'm doing great. How about yourself?
Hey, listen, I'm great. I know we were just chatting about, you know, working out and making it happen. And listen, a lot of high performers are watching this or will watch it. Authors, speakers, entrepreneurs, coaches. But I'll just give a quick backstory to how we met. We met through Dan Sullivan's Strategic Coach program. And I know that, hey, listen, I'm a publisher, I'm an author. And so I'm kind of in the business of publishing people's intellectual property. And Dan kept talking about you and Keegan and the amazing work, Keegan Caldwell, that you're doing. Fastest growing law firm, IP. In fact, let's talk about that. But give us a quick story, because I sat down with you. I hired you. We'll talk about that here in a moment.
That's right.
But I'm very impressed with all you're doing. And I want to tell people, we already have Lisa and Tanisha and people from all over. I'd love for people to share this, because I'll tell you what, folks, if you are in the business of creating any type of intellectual property, I know Lisa's a safari photographer, Tanisha's an author. You need to pay attention. You need to share this right now, because you are literally going to get thousands of dollars worth of value. So, Katie, tell us about yourself and Caldwell IP.
Sure. So what we try to do here at Caldwell is we help our clients create intellectual property strategies that align with their business objectives. And what I mean by that is thinking about what is the future plans for the business, what sort of the next stage of growth, the next milestone you want to achieve, and how can we use the intellectual property that you've created to help you hit those milestones and get there and really achieve a return on investment for what you're going to put in to go about acquiring that piece of intellectual property.
Yeah.
So, you know, one example I'll just talk about briefly maybe is patents. Everybody thinks, okay, patents are just going to really kind of protect what I'm creating, right? And while that's one part of it, we can also use patents for various different purposes. For example, we can use them if you're gearing up for maybe a round of funding, venture funding, right? Well, since from 2011 to 2018, 70% of all VC funding went to companies that had patents. So
wow.
Right there, just by getting a patent, you're going to have an advantage. Or if, let's say, we want to maybe create the opportunity to maybe someday license the patent to somebody else operating in the space, maybe a collaborator, right? Somebody we know we want to work together with, and we have some unique methodologies that could be appealing to them.
Oh, that's good.
And we can also use patents to create licensing opportunities and really obtain passive income from this asset that we've decided to invest in.
Wow. I'm writing notes here because I...
Okay.
I swear every time I talk to you, I'm like, ooh, that's good. That's good. So I've thought prior to coming into this conversation, and I'm not a lawyer, but I've done a lot of research because I'm fascinated by creativity and I'm fascinated by ideas and protecting these ideas. It's interesting. Some people are into real estate and physical property. I'm into imagination and intellectual property. I always have been. And so I kind of came into this conversation today thinking that patents make sense if you're going to sell, borrow, or sue, right? So if you're going to sell your company someday, or what I heard you just say is funding, which is a way of essentially selling some of the equity a little bit, right? I mean, that's kind of a strategy, right? Fundraising, selling, you know, a little bit of the equity, borrowing, and we'll get into that here in a moment, how that's now possible. And it hasn't been for years, but now it is. And then lawsuits, like suing, like as in protecting and defense and offense. So let's kind of unpack a little bit of those. First of all, is that, would you agree with that? That patents make sense in those three scenarios, or am I missing something?
I would say yes. I'd say the other scenario too is also if you're going to go public, right? If you're going to have an IPO, well, companies that hold patents at the time of IPO, they're usually on average valued about 13.2% higher than companies that don't have patents. So if that's a long-term goal, really gearing up the portfolio to be very valuable and extract that kind of tech multiplier at IPO is also an important strategy to think about long-term too.
Makes sense. I love it. Okay. And then borrowing is kind of a unique thing these days, where I know not everybody wants to borrow, but there is a strategy with patents as well. And let's talk about that, because then we'll move into kind of like why we hired you and some strategy there. But borrowing, what about patents and borrowing?
Sure. So that's a great question. So lately there's been some relatively newer programs where companies can get debt-based funding, basically a debt note based on the value of their intellectual property, mostly patent portfolio. And really, the reason this is cropping up, we're seeing more of these programs start to pop up, is because there's been a real shift over the past 40 years or so in companies tapping into and extracting value out of intangible assets. So in 1970, about 17% or so of the value of the S&P 500 was made up of intangible assets. And yep, you've got the figure here on the screen. Whereas in 2020, that number now is up to 90%, which is a huge shift from investing into physical property, you know, things like real estate and machinery, items like that, to this shift to now we're really putting all of the value in the investment into patents, trademarks, copyrights, trade secrets, company know-how, all of these intangible assets.
That's so good.
So good.
Let me just stop right there for a second. So you're basically saying that, like, this AirPod case, you know, and AirPods, that the real value of this isn't in the plastic and isn't in the parts. It's in the patents that really make up this invention.
That's right.
Yeah.
In an invention like that, those AirPods, that's probably covered with maybe 50 to 100 different patents just on the AirPods alone, which is just, you know, incredible. Same with a cell phone, right?
Yeah.
An average cell phone is probably protected with well over 1,000 patents on different unique features, electrical components, display systems. So there's a lot of intellectual property just in these everyday items we use, which is also really mind blowing too.
So I know you have a copy of my book. I mentioned you and Keegan in it. I'm really honored that you all have been my lawyers through this patent process we're going to talk about in a moment. But in a way, Katie, it's almost like the analogy is the value of this book is not in the paper or the color, just like not in the plastic. The value of a book is in the ideas, which is what we're talking about today, what we want to protect.
And that's a great point too, because I know there's a lot of different sort of artists and sort of creative folks on the phone here today.
Yes.
And so just thinking about the intellectual property in a book, and I have the book here right on my desk too, And so if, you know, you go and write a book or let's say create any kind of creative work, right? Like a movie or even a podcast like we're recording right now, all of that, you have a copyright exists automatically as soon as that work is in some sort of, the standard here is fixed medium. But what the government does is allows you to then register that copyright at the copyright office. And the reason that's important to take that extra step to do that registration is because then if somebody plagiarizes your content, starts to, you know, impersonate what all that work you've put into this book, then by having that copyright registered, you can then go sue them and get what's called treble damages, meaning three times monetary damages for that plagiarism that's happening. So that's sort of another incentive and reason why protecting the IP, really thinking it through, can be so important there.
Yeah. And I want people to realize, like, so for example, we have Lisa who's watching, and Lisa's photography, she is world class. She goes to Africa, does these photos, and really it's about animal conservation. She blows my mind because she will educate me on how valuable animals are and how even little tourist things that we think are helping them might actually be hurting them. And so she's blown my mind. But Lisa's an example of her photography. And if she puts that in a book or if she has a process, we've even chatted about her having a process of doing safaris in a ethical way that honors conservation, environmentalism, that could all be patented. What do you think? I don't know. I'm asking, like, could even her process be patented even in something like animal safari?
Yes. If it's a unique methodology, meaning, you know, there's something new.
Yeah.
This is sort of the trick with patenting is that you don't, you know, all innovation today really is the sum of known parts, but it's sort of that unique combination of those parts. What are you putting together that's new that creates this opportunity for patenting? So in an example like that, if there's a unique step or, you know, a unique set of steps that she's performing there, that would all be something she could consider patenting there. But the photographs themselves, that would be more lend itself towards copyright protection.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. So it's really the assembly of the parts for a methodology. In the past, patents were always thought of as technology. What years did you kind of see the shift happen where I think our buddy Dan Sullivan says that because of the internet, all methodologies essentially are technology based because they're on the internet. When did we see that switch?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think a lot of the shift happened sort of over the past few years, how there's been, you know, every invention nowadays, there's some sort of application, mobile app, digital app that goes along with it. And so there's been sort of new rules at the patent office about patenting software and technology. And so that sort of helped open up these opportunities to really protect some of those digital-based inventions and sort of methodologies as they're practiced on a computer software program, let's say.
There's one lawyer I follow on Twitter, and she seems to have an in with the USPTO where she'll just literally, with permission, publicly share who filed that day for patents that are coming regarding the Web3 or the metaverse or NFTs or these types of things. And it's mind-blowing. Like, it's companies that we would have thought, what, you know, Barbie? What's up with, you know, Barbie or Gucci or, you know, Domino's Pizza? Like, the most random things, it seems like everyone's starting to realize that slide that you just shared, that the value of a company is truly based upon the IP, which is essentially now in our day and age, the digital assets. Like, we've moved from physical assets to digital assets. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, I agree with that completely. I mean, my office is located in downtown Boston, so I'm very close to the campuses of Harvard and MIT.
Yeah.
We've been seeing a ton of this sort of technology spinning out of the university for the past 5 years or so. And there's been, you know, a huge run on patents on different blockchain sort of web three applications and kind of these things that maybe we used to do by pen and paper, right? Now we can put that all digitally on this blockchain. And so there's real opportunities in that digital shift.
Yep.
To create patents around these new ways this is done in these different applications. Same with the metaverse too, right? I mean, I think Facebook filed patents last year on different ways to order food in the metaverse. So we're seeing this convergence of these things we used to just do very simply, you know, picking up the phone and calling a restaurant. Now
yeah.
It's all digitalized. And so there's a huge opportunity to protect all of those spaces.
Yeah. I mean, I look at the window outside you there. It's a beautiful city and you're in, remind me, is it Boston?
Boston. Yeah.
Yeah. So you're in Boston and let's just assume that we had the ability to buy downtown real estate years and years and years ago before there were any skyscrapers. That land would have been very cheap because nobody saw, or at least it wasn't realized, the potential for the population, traffic, all these things. Metaverse and the digital world. I mean, I know that Seoul, Korea is like building a digital twin. Orlando, you know, mm-hmm. you see some of these countries and cities that are saying, we're just going to create a whole nother digital world because we need that integration between physical and digital. So I can imagine Caldwell IP, even though you're the fastest growing law firm now, when this starts really tipping, oh my gosh, do you see yourself ever sleeping?
I make sure to put that into my calendar.
Yes. Yes. But people literally have, let's talk about that. It used to be first to use, first use case. Now it's first to file in terms of intellectual property. So let's set that up a little bit. Why the change? And
yeah.
Is that good or bad? And I know again,
that's a great question. Yeah. So basically in the United States in 2013, we underwent this major shift in the patent system, where before that, we used to be in this first to invent patent system. So basically, what that meant was whoever created the invention first in time, they got rights to the patent on it. Didn't matter sort of when in time they went and filed it, as long as they could prove they invented it first, they would get the rights to it. And at the time, the U.S. was sort of the lone outlier where every other country was basically at that point operating on this first to file patent system. So we were sort of still under this old regime. And it was hard to sort of always prove, did you really create the invention first? Because you had to have really good documentation of it, you know, have all these notes in a lab notebook and really be able to prove you had conception of that invention. So in 2013, the America Invents Act, you'll also hear it referred to as the AIA, that was put into place. And what that did is it shifted us over to this first to file patent system. So what that means is who doesn't matter who invented it first, whoever gets that patent filed at the patent office, first based on a calendar day basis, they get rights to that invention.
Wow.
And so this is like a huge shift. There's still, because we just did that shift, you know, about 10 years ago, there's still patents that have been filed already that exist that are still under this old regime of law. So we're still sort of operating under these dual systems. But right now, today, if you were to go file a patent, it would be who's ever first in time is the inventor of that patent.
And a patent is essentially, correct me if I'm wrong, but it, at least with technology, it seems to be like it's a 20-year monopoly on that invention. Is that kind of a way of thinking of it?
That's right. What it is basically you file the patent and you get rights in that invention from 20 years from the day of filing. Mm-hmm. And after that, then the patent will basically expire and the technology will go into the public domain. But there's different ways and sort of strategies that come into play, how to kind of extend it beyond the 20-year term. And sort of if, let's say, your technology shifts a little bit, how do we capture those changes and get sure. new patent terms going? And so there's a lot of different factors we can take into account, but it basically is this 20-year monopoly where you get the sole exclusive rights on that invention. Yeah.
So folks, I want you to all listen up because we're going to move into our patent, EZIP, but here's a little of the background. So Katie, my first book came out in 2004. So we're almost at 20 years. And so I've been in this publishing industry for about 20 years, and I've done a dozen books myself, but I pretty much published about 1,000 other authors. And we started our publishing company in 2014. So over the years, I've seen incredible creativity come out. And some should probably only be in a book and will only be in a book. But our model is 18 streams of income. You know, that's our model. That's kind of what makes us different than any other publisher. We say your book is not a business card. Your book is a business. And we say that, you know, nobody ever stood up and said, I got my wife's business card here. Nobody ever stood up and said, this business card changed my life. Mm-hmm. You know, but what people have said is this book has changed my life. So books, I am a big fan of books. And I believe some books have within them those methodologies. Like you and I are friends with Gino Wickman and EOS. EOS has turned a book, Traction, into an incredible empire of business tools and methodologies. That's just one example. You know, Simon Sinek, who came up with the golden circle and start with why, another guy, you know, another example, Brené Brown. Like I could just go through the list, and I know all these authors who have like leveraged their ideas into physical or digital manifestations of methodology. So I came to you last summer and said, hey, listen, I've been studying a lot about blockchain. And why? Not because I just have a nerdy habit, but it was to say that I saw the publishing industry shifting, right? And so I came to you and Keegan, and I basically said, I think we've developed this unique methodology, which now is called EZIP, but it's essentially a way to protect. I would call it a pre-patent with blockchain technology and QR codes and this type of thing. What did you think, first of all? Because I know you weren't just like, cool, you know, pay us 20K, you're in. But you had to like think through it and do a search and like say, is this truly unique? Can you tell the crowd some of the due diligence that you have to do when a patent might come up?
Absolutely. No, that's a great point. So what we did when we first started working with you was we had a phone call and you kind of walked us through the technology, showed us how it worked. And there seemed to be some really unique concepts you had integrated in. You weren't just looking to patent the blockchain, right, itself. You were using sort of a unique methodology to put information on the blockchain, how you were obtaining that information, subject matter of that information and kind of what you were doing with that. So we kind of took all that information in, and then we did this thing called a patentability search, where we wrote up a summary of your invention and sent it off to this search firm that just does these searches all day long.
Wow.
And so they're very good at what they do, right? They know where to go find other patents or publications that are similar to this idea we've told them about. And
by the way, you handed me back that report and I'm like,
yes,
please interpret, because it was intense. It was really cool.
Yes, the reports that come back are super technical. I always tell people it's not even worth me sharing it with you, but if you really want to see it, I will. But it's basically going to be a piece of literature that you can read at night when you have insomnia and want to read it sleep, because it's just very, there's a lot of information in there. And the reason the search is important is because it lets us know, really, before we put pen to paper and start writing that patent, it gives us an idea of what other patents or, you know, research articles, journal articles, just even blogs, let's say, but what exists on this topic already.
Yep.
And so that helps us know, number one, is this going to be worthwhile and be a sound business investment to move forward with the patent? Because if it's already been done and it's very crowded, maybe getting you another patent that's kind of very narrow in scope, maybe that's not going to make the most business sense. And at that point, maybe we think about some other way to protect this idea, right?
Sure.
Whereas if there is some white space, then this lets us know, okay, how can we write this patent for you in a way that we can really carve out as much scope and really get as broad coverage as possible, so that we really start to build that moat of protection for you around your invention.
Yeah, I like that a lot. Okay, so you did the due diligence. We looked, we saw white space. We sat down, me and some of your colleagues, and we began to basically explain that. And I know we brought Sarah, our integrator, on, and we basically, you know, came up with this powered by EZIP, this QR code technology that, when upon scanning, goes back to a source that then demonstrates the fact that your intellectual property is protected on the blockchain. And again, I tell people right out of the gate, I'm like, look, this is not to replace a patent, because a patent is, I call it, you know, this is probably inaccurate, but I call it the nuclear weapon of IP protection. Like it's big. I mean, it's big. And yet there's a lot of people watching this right now that they're authors, they're creators. Maybe they don't have the time or money to really protect all of their IP, nor do they want to buy, sell, or sue. So when does this make sense? When does EZIP make sense? And can it almost be a first step for people that then may take some of their IP and go with Caldwell IP in the near future?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what I like about what you're doing here is that right now, to go, if you're an author, right, to know if you're, let's say, plagiarizing someone else's work, you know, digging through those archives at the copyright office, it's very complex. It's hard to search, right? And so where you have basically taken someone's published work and put it on the blockchain, you're creating this, you know, fixed record that then I know, okay, as of this date and time, this person has this book. And so it's very informative to know this is protected already and to really put it out there to the world. Hey, here's my stamp with my digital signature of when I had possession of this copyright.
Ooh, right? I like that. 'Cause all IP is really based on time, meaning I'm not a billionaire with the McDonald's golden arches because I came up with it in 2023. They had the time on their side way back when. So IP really is a time game in some ways. I thought of it first, or somebody, and they filed it. And then what we're seeing, you and I chatted a while on this, but remember back in the day where you had to do a wet signature? Remember, like prior to 2000, you had to literally sign something, and then that was a contract. And I think it was 2000 where they said digital signatures have the same weight. And then it opened up all kinds of new business and capabilities. Well, I believe we're at a smart contract moment where I kind of get updates every day. I'm a little bit nerdy like that, but I'm starting to see in the world that smart contracts are beginning to take weight in countries and certain states that it's almost that wet signature moment with smart contracts. Are you kind of hearing that or seeing that, or what are you thinking?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I think too with the sort of technological shift during COVID when we couldn't be in person to do a lot of those wet
Interesting.
signatures anymore, there's also been different laws that have loosened up, digital things that maybe before COVID they weren't accepting. That there's now a shift towards that's going to basically ultimately replace
Wow.
wet signatures
Yeah.
eventually.
That makes sense though, because yeah, I mean, I even saw the BMV, Bureau of Motor Vehicle, make concessions during COVID where prior to COVID, they're like, you got to show up, you got to prove this. And it's like everyone had to pivot to say, well, we are now a digital world, and how do we work within that rather than fight against it?
That's right. Exactly.
Interesting. Interesting. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about this then regarding EZIP. So we filed in October, and now that puts us into what do you call it? Patent pending.
That's right.
So what's, I know I bug you once in a while where I'm like, did you hear anything yet? And I know it takes time, but that's actually part of why EZIP, I think, does have some attraction. I'll share this with you. It is the nuclear weapon patents, but they do cost a lot, and they take a lot of time. But then you get amazing benefits, like you're talking about. The valuation of the company goes up. The IPO, when you 13 point, would you say 2% or something like that?
That's right.
Yeah. So I mean, you get all these great benefits with a patent, but they do cost time and money. And EZIP, we can get that in almost like a pre-patent smart contract fast. So it's patent pending. What's going to happen now?
Yeah. So that's a good point. So typically, when you file a patent, there's sort of two different tracks the patent can get examined under. So if you just file it normally, could take anywhere from 3 to 5 years to get
Wow.
that patent approved at the patent office, right? It's kind of a long, drawn out process. So as part of this America Invents Act back in 2013, what the patent office did was they started this program called this Track One Expedited Review Program. And what it is they only allow right now 15,000 patents per year to be filed on this track. But what you do, you basically pay the government a little bit extra in government filing fees, but you get a determination of patentability within 12 months from filing. So what that basically means is that instead of that 3 to 5 year wait, you can get that patent in hand in about 12 months. So it's a very fast process. And we, our firm, we file, thousands of patents each year under this program. And what we've noticed, because we really see the value add here for our clients to be able to, number one, get that issued patent in hand quickly so that then they can go do whatever they want to do with that patent that much
Sure.
sooner. But the other value add too is that what that means is now your patent is going to be picked up and reviewed by a patent examiner within, 6 months or so of filing. So what that means, whereas if you don't expedite it, it's going to take maybe 3 years before that examiner picks it up and looks at it. So that means that examiner is going to have 3 years extra knowledge in that area. Other publications will have come out. They're going to have that much more information.
Yeah.
Inspect your patent that much easier. So what we've noticed the real value add with this fast track program too is that we can get that patent to an allowance even quicker because we have to do less arguing with the patent office because there's less sort of grounds and areas for them to reject the patent with.
I love it. I love it. I see you as and Caldwell IP and Keegan, your whole amazing firm, which my family and I are going to visit you this summer. I was telling my son on my phone, I'm like, check out this 59th floor. Is it the 59th floor?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And I said, they're fantastic. And so he's very excited. And his name is Keegan. My son's name is Keegan. So
that's a small world.
It's funny.
I didn't know that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So Keegan and Keegan are going to meet. And he's a basketball fan. So I think Keegan's going to be like the coolest guy to him. Cause I know Keegan likes Celtics and, goes to Laker games with Chad Willardson and all that. But long story short, I see you kind of as the definite go-to when you have an idea worth protecting that will require an investment of time. And for some people's budget, significant budget. Now, other people are just like, that's not that much money. But let's talk about when you do file a patent, how much value you can put on your assets.
Yeah.
Because 20K sounds like a lot and it is, but then you can also turn around and add that. Tell us that number.
Yeah, sure. So we get asked sort of all the time, if I file this patent and I get this patent, what is the monetary value of that patent? Right. And so typically it's hard to know offhand because this is an intangible asset, right? So if we were to go figure out the value, normally we only value portfolios that have, I'd say 10 or more patents because it's very expensive and it takes a lot of work to figure this out. But what we have to go do is figure out who would be potential licensees of the patent, who's actively infringing the patent, because if there's active infringement or what we call evidence of use, then the value is just that much greater. So what it is, we have some rough estimate dollar amounts of monetary values of patents being sold on the brokered patent market. And what that basically means is that patent brokers, they're kind of like real estate brokers, where if we need to go sell off some assets because we're winding up a company, we go list our patents with these brokers and then they'll sell them to an interested buyer. So the data that we have right now is that as soon as you file a patent and you have patent pending, right? Kind of like the position you're in right now, Carrie, where you filed this patent, it's undergoing examination,
sure,
but it hasn't been approved yet. Right then, you have an asset that on average is worth about $300,000. As soon as that patent is approved and the patent examiner says, okay, you have rights in that invention, that number goes up to about $420,000. So this is coming from, these numbers are coming from the Richardson Oliver Patent Insights. They're basically the preeminent firm that does these studies of these sales of patents through patent brokers each year. Yeah. This is relatively new data that's come out in the past 5 years, because before 5 years ago, most of this data was kept confidential.
Sure.
So there's been new ways to kind of leverage transparency in this. But the thing to remember here too is that these are sort of low-end numbers. What I mean by that is these are, you know, on our worst day, if the company's going out of business and we need to generate revenue, what yeah. sort of that dollar amount we're going to get. Whereas if we were going to go sell this patent, let's say, to a competitor, the pricing is going to look different than these numbers of the patents sold through brokers.
Makes sense. I love it. So as an author, as a publisher, you know, my passion is really protecting our authors. And I know that, of course, our books, we get a Library of Congress control number, we get a copyright. But in addition to that, now all of our books do include that powered by EZIP patent pending protection. But I do want to show you what this looks like in real time for the observer who's watching and saying, you know, what is all this? So this is our registry. And when I click O for Oberbrunner, let me know if you can you still see that? Is it showing?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
So then I go there. And then here's my example of my different types of EZIP protected IP. And then, yeah, we go to the blockchain. And now, unfortunately, I got to stop sharing my screen. Then I got to start sharing it again here. But I do want to show people the cool little piece of this, because now you come to essentially OpenSea, which is a place that houses digital assets. And we come down, we click details, we can see the contract address and then the token ID. And so truly, this is the... And I'll share one more screen, Katie. Sorry, now I got to go to the actual blockchain. StreamYard isn't friendly for all this types of jumping. But now we are on Polygon, which is Ethereum blockchain. And there is my, you know, intellectual property, Carrie Oberbrunner verified IP. And like you just said, it's the timestamp that forever and ever and ever on a blockchain distributed ledger, which cannot be altered, it's immutable, I can prove first use case and essentially first to file with that smart contract. So Katie, for the non-techie person, like, why does that matter? You know, my potential client out there, because you are my lawyer too, but why is that really cutting edge? Why is that exciting for this new creator economy?
Yeah. I think what's most exciting about something like this is, to me, in my mind, it's all about ownership, right? To prove, hey, I own this. Here's this immutable ledger that proves that. Because I think, too, eventually... What's interesting is that there's been a lot of talk too at the patent office with this first to file patent system that right now it's all about the day on which you file, right? But what happens if two people file the same invention on the same day?
Ooh.
So this is going to become just more important over time, because eventually it's going to have to come down to, you know, what's the hour and the minute at which you file.
Yeah.
And so it's all about, just like in when we were talking about the pre-AIA, when it was first to invent, you know, how do you really prove that? And, you know, that's where something like blockchain can really become very useful, because it is that immutable ledger that proves proof of ownership.
I like what you're saying, because I've, you know, I do not know financial markets, but I've heard that certain markets and firms invested in fiber optic so that they could get faster data, so that they could make more informed stock decisions. And the amount of money based on seconds and microseconds were like mind blowing. And I hear what you're saying. You're saying basically, USPTO used to count the day, but because we're now living in such an economy, a creator economy, that's ideas are generating so much faster, I mean, we can have meetings with people in other countries, you know, live stream and all this type of thing. You are saying that it comes down to minutes and seconds.
It doesn't right now. There's no legal basis for that, but yeah. I anticipate in the future,
yeah.
you know, there's going to be some court case that takes it there because we're in such a digital age of creativity. And I think we've even seen the shift too in the past few months with Chat GPT, how fast that can innovate things for us. So I feel like, you know, that's an issue, a question we'll see play out relatively soon here.
I love it. In fact, I got tapped to speak at the USPTO panel and I quickly went to you and said, do you think I should do it or do you think I shouldn't? And I love what you said. You said, go for it. So I did. And that was in January. But this is all at the easyip.today. But here's that talk. Here's that 9-minute talk that I gave. And then I thought it was interesting. And maybe you can just chat and we'll kind of land the plane here in a moment. But I was able to speak on that panel. And, you know, you had some really smart people like you. that did the you know, lawyer test, and you got Harvard here and stuff. But why do you think the USPTO said, look, we're gonna take orders from Congress commissioned panel to even talk about how intellectual property and digital assets or blockchain or NFTs is now a thing? Like, why do you think this is coming?
Yeah. That's a great question. So I think a lot of this comes into play because this is such new technology that there's a lot of uncertainty about how do these intellectual property rights play into this. And I think we've seen that recently, let's say in NFTs, right? If once you create NFTs, there's uncertainty who really owns the copyright NFT. If you put someone else's, like a Chanel logo, right, into an NFT, are you then infringing Chanel's trademarks on it? So there's all these different questions. And so I think this was sort of the first step to really get a sense for the USPTO from people who are working in this field every day to get a sense of what issues exist. Kind of where do we see some of these uncertainties? And then probably the USPTO will provide some guidance, some draft guidance on here's where our line of thinking is right now. But that can shift too, depending on what might, you know, happen before a judge in a court. And so it just kind of creates more opportunity to start the discussion because there's so many unknowns here.
I'll tell you what, 10, 15 years ago, when I first started signing my first book contracts with publishers, they would have this clause that says, you know, we own the rights as the publisher for ebook, audiobook, and all future inventions. You know, like, in other words, they even realized 15 years ago, there's new ways of interpreting a book. Maybe it'll be brain implants or something. But I mean, you have to almost be thinking of the future. You cannot be in a industry that just says, here it is, and we're not going to go outside those lines.
Right. And I always tell people this with patents too, because a lot of times when I send them, probably you had this experience too, Carrie, when we sent you the draft of your patent application, you were like, why did you write all this other stuff, kind of futuristic stuff into it? And, you know, like, clients will ask me, why did you write that this could also include machine learning? And so I like to tell people, look, the reason being, the patent is going to be good for a term of 20 years. So we want to try and capture not only what you're doing today, but also what do those future use cases and applications look like that we can start to plant in there from now, so that in that first to file patent system, we can claim ownership of it, even if we're not doing it that way right away.
Wow. I love that. Well, folks, just a few parting words here, but number one, I wanted Katie to come because she's added so much value to me and Keegan as well. In fact, you know, I put you guys in the book as a thank you, because I just know that I wouldn't be here, you know, without you. And now in every single book that we publish, you know, we essentially put a blockchain verified IP back ad. And what this does, I think what's pretty cool about this too, Katie, is anybody can fake on a Mac or a PC just with a few keystrokes, like an R or a C or a TM, you know? I'm not saying they fake it, but like, you know, you can create it. And then we have to say, well, was that real? And then we have to go look and we have to go do all this work to prove if that's a real registered copyright. The beauty of, I think, Easy IP is you just open any phone on the planet, scan it, and immediately you're taken to the blockchain where you cannot dispute the owner, you know? And so that's kind of what I'm excited about with our creators and authors is to show that. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I'm excited about something like that too, because I feel like sometimes, especially with creative works, you know, everybody throws a copyright on it, and they can, but it's taking it that one extra step further to register the copyright. And so, you know, how do you know they really registered it? You'd have to go look it up. And so if I can take that out, that question out, and just scan something on the phone and know if it's registered or not, that's just like so much easier and quicker.
Yeah.
Sort that out.
Well, and that's where you and your team were awesome, because, you know, we chatted about that QR code technology, and I see it, you know, going on, I'm in my wife's office here, but like lotion, I mean, anything, I see it going on all kinds of products that, you know, you can just say, look, Purell, do they really own it? Scan the QR code and see if they own the, you know, the blockchain verified IP. So, well, Katie, this was awesome. I know your website is Caldwell IP. Anything else that you want to say? I mean, you've been so helpful today, and we'll finish up offline for the last 3 minutes, but anything else for the crowd here today?
No, I would just say to the crowd, it's always better, especially in this age of innovation, you know, it's always better to start thinking about things earlier and get planning on the IP ahead of time, because sort of locking that down first is really, you know, the initial step. You don't need to have your whole company drawn out. You don't need to have, you know, products made, but just locking down the IP can be so important for years to come, so that you really, you know, get that ownership and get it going sooner.
I love it. It's so good. Yeah. Not Jeff Bezos, I mean, whoever, Elon Musk, anybody, these people, Sarah Blakely, Spanks. I mean, you don't think you have a gold mine in the beginning. No. And yet once you do, it's almost too late.
Then. Exactly.
Interesting. Yeah. Oh, that's a good tip. Okay. Well, folks, on that point, you know, and we have a lot of people saying thanks. Sarah's been watching as well. And we're going to put this on YouTube and all kinds of things. But thank you, Katie, for giving your incredible wisdom today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. It was a lot of fun.
Awesome.
Thank you for listening to the eMind Podcast with Dr. Carrie Oberbrunner. We look forward to hearing from you and how you're applying the eMind. Please share your story by submitting a review on your platform of choice. We read every single one. This podcast is sponsored by Igniting Souls and Cedarville University. Visit ignitingsouls.com/emind and cedarville.edu for more help in your entrepreneurial journey.